Thank you. So my name is Larry Kramer, and I'm the dean here at Stanford Law School, for those of you who don't know. And it's my pleasure to welcome you all to this very special event and to introduce Barbara Vancevic. So for most of you, I think Barbara presumably needs no introduction. You're here because you know something about her and her remarkable book. But as I assume that's not true for all of you, let me tell you a few things about Barbara and about the book. Barbara joined the faculty here at Stanford as an assistant professor in 2006. She was promoted to associate professor last year. I should say bringing Barbara here is one of my prouder moments as dean, not least because persuading her to come here was no mean feat. Barbara was by far the most highly sought after person on the job market the year she was on it, and for good reason. She brought unique training to the job, having both a law degree and a PhD in computer science. She had, moreover, earned highest honors in both degrees and was, in fact, one of the top students in Germany in both fields simultaneously. And when I say one of the top students, I mean literally one of the top first or fourth, I think, in each field. Before entering the job market, Barbara had already begun to establish a reputation based on her dissertation and on her early research. And she gave one of the best job talks any of us had seen at Stanford in many years. What came across instantly in the job talk, I mean, something that is evident in the book and something you'll see in a few minutes, I think, when Barbara speaks, is that she is among the clearest thinkers any of us had ever met, as well as unbelievably, and I want to emphasize the unbelievably thorough. Someone would ask a question, Barbara would listen and then say, I have 17 responses to that, one, little A, little B1, little B2, little C, two. It was scarily impressive. Since joining the faculty, Barbara has continued to develop her expertise. She teaches communications law and will soon add classes in antitrust and on the use of intellectual property. Her research focuses on the economic, regulatory, and strategic implications of communications networks. In particular, she explores how changes in the architecture of computer networks affect the economic environment for innovation and competition on the internet and how the law should handle those changes. Questions like this are actually still somewhat new and exotic in law schools. I like to say that universities tend to lag 10 to 15 years behind the rest of society in confronting important questions, and law schools tend to lag 10 to 15 years behind the rest of society, behind the rest of the university. And because that's true, the questions Barbara addresses, while still somewhat new in most law schools, are among today's most important public policy questions and issues. The decisions and choices that we make now about the structure of the internet are going to profoundly affect and determine intellectual, economic, and cultural developments for the foreseeable future. Everything from free speech to economic competitiveness to innovation in technology and business will be affected and is at stake in the choices we make on precisely the questions that Barbara addresses. Which brings me to the book and the subject of her talk tonight. Informatively, though I have to say not exactly scintillatingly entitled, Internet Architecture and Innovation, Barbara's book is already considered the authoritative work in the network neutrality debate and has been widely hailed as both a major scholarly achievement and a practical primer for policymakers. The book is relevant, indeed important for many audiences, all hopefully, and I think looking out, represented here tonight. It needs to be read by internet entrepreneurs and investors whose business will be affected by how open the net is. It needs to be read by network engineers thinking about the future of the internet and what it should look like. By regulators required to figure out how to allocate this resource and how to maximize efficacy. And of course by academics working in this emerging area of the law. Though just recently published, Internet Architecture and Innovation is already having a powerful influence. It's being read and taken seriously by FCC and other regulators in Washington and in other countries, and Barbara's work has already influenced regulators in Canada and Europe as well as in the United States. And the reason is simple. It's a great book. Internet Architecture and Innovation is interdisciplinary in the best and deepest sense of the term. It draws from and informs economics, computer science, law, and communications policy in a way that's of real use to experts in those fields and recognizable to them as a peer speaking. It has something to teach engineers about how to create a system, to teach lawyers about what rules to put in place, and to teach business people about where and how to invest. As important, while the book has a definite argument and a point of view, it is fair, reasonable, and not surprisingly, given what I said earlier, very, very thorough. Even the strongest opponents of net neutrality concede that there is much in Barbara's analysis and arguments that they need to take seriously and address. It's the kind of scholarship, in truth, that we all aspire to produce. And now let's show you why and bring Barbara up here to explain more about the substance of the book. So please join me in welcoming Barbara Vencevic.
Thanks, Larry, for your kind introduction. Makes me speechless. Hopefully not for so too long, because you know you are here to hear me speak. And thank you all for coming. I mean, it's really special for me to be here tonight, because many of you who are here have in one way or the other influenced the development of this book, some in very profane ways, like you know helping me find the books that I needed or making sure they got to my desk, but a lot of you, you know, talking with me about these issues or just offering moral support. And of course, Larry, our dean, has been great and very supportive. And so I have much to be grateful for. And I also want to thank Elaine Adolfo, our new associate director at the Center for Internet and Society, and Amanda, who is sitting right next to her, Amanda Smith, who put this event together. Our timing couldn't be better. On the one hand, it's exactly 10 years ago that the Center for Internet and Society put on its first conferences on the policy implications of end-to-end, and a little bit less geeky on the policy implications of internet architecture. And since that conference, the debates over these issues have moved from academia to the real world. And that became very, very clear last night when the chairman of the FCC, Julius Janikowski, circulated to his fellow commissioners a network neutrality order which he would like the commission to adopt at its December 21st open meeting. So if you care about network neutrality, the next 3 weeks will be your last chance to make your voice heard. And so there is basically no better time than tonight to take a step back and think about what this debate is all about. You'll note that my talk itself doesn't really talk a lot about the chairman's proposal, and that's because I really want you to get a big picture of the debate before we get to talk about his suggestions, and I think we'll have ample opportunity to do so throughout the evening. But let's start at the beginning with the internet's impact on innovation. In the past 30 to 40 years, the internet has created an enormous amount of innovation and applications. In my book, I argue that this is not an accident, but a result of the internet's internal structure, or as network engineers call it, its architecture. Today, the architecture of the internet is changing. Some changes are driven by network providers' desire for more profits. Some changes are the reaction to technical challenges that the internet is facing. But all these changes raise an important question. What exactly are the factors that have fostered application innovation in the past? Because they need to be preserved through technology or law if we want the internet to serve as an engine of innovation in the future. I'll talk about these factors through three stories. Here's the first. In the mid-1990s, a software engineer in Silicon Valley named Pierre Armadia thought, wouldn't it be nice if we could buy and sell things over the internet using auctions to determine the price? Most of his friends thought he was crazy. Strangers will never buy from strangers online, they said. But Pierre Armadia didn't care about this. He stayed home over Labor Day weekend 1995, wrote his software, and put it online. 9 months later, so many people were using his platform that he decided to quit his day job and focus on the platform full-time. The platform, renamed eBay, became a huge success, and today more than 88 million people worldwide are using eBay to buy and sell things over the internet. Three aspects are important here. Pierre Armédiat had an idea for an application. People thought it was crazy, but it didn't matter. In particular, it didn't matter whether network providers believed that strangers would ever buy from strangers online. And that's because on the internet, network providers don't have to do anything to enable new applications to run. That's a consequence of the internet's architecture. The internet was based on a design principle called the end-to-end arguments. As I show in my book, there are actually two versions of the end-to-end arguments, which has created a lot of confusion in the past. Here, I'm talking about the broad version of the end-to-end arguments. And I should add that this design principle and both versions of it were first described by Jerome Seltzer, David Reed, and David Clark. Following the broad version of the end-to-end arguments, the network was designed to be as general as possible in order to support a wide variety of applications with different needs. So when a new application comes along, the network doesn't have to be changed to allow the application to run. All the innovator has to do is write a program that runs on a computer attached to the internet. As a result, an innovator does not have to convince network providers that her application is useful or will be commercially successful. The only person who needs to be convinced that this is a good idea is the innovator herself. This greatly increases the chance that innovative ideas will be realized. Second, when the application has been written, the network doesn't have to be changed before it can run on the network. If you want to use it, you install it on your computer. That's it. The only person who needs to be convinced that this application may be useful is the person who actually wants to use it. This greatly increases the chance that people can actually use new applications. And third, in this architecture, it doesn't cost a lot to develop new applications. You need access to a computer, be able to program, and time to actually write the program. This greatly increases the number and type of people who can develop new applications. Like Pierre Armédiat, you don't have to be an employee of a firm or have outside funding to realize your idea for an application. The biggest investment is often the design and programming of the application itself. And so you can develop an application in your free time or as a side project. Under these conditions, an application doesn't have to produce a profit in the future to cover the cost of developing it. Instead, a wide range of benefits, for example, I just like to program, or I'd like to use this application myself, may be sufficient to cover the development costs. Thus, the architecture allows innovators with a wide range of motivations and funding models to develop applications. So three aspects. Innovators independently decide whether to realize innovative ideas. They do not need support or permission from network providers in order to innovate. Users independently decide which applications they want to use. And the low cost of application innovation enable a very large and diverse group of people to develop new applications. That was the first story. Here's the second. In 2002, two European entrepreneurs named Niklas Zennström and Janos Fries thought, wouldn't it be nice if we could use peer-to-peer software to make phone calls over the internet? At the time, most network engineers didn't think this would work. They thought internet telephony required special treatment from the network, something we call quality of service. Network providers weren't really interested in internet telephony because it constituted a huge threat to their business model. But Zennström and Fries didn't care about this. They went ahead, developed their software. The software became Skype, and today more than 500 million people worldwide are using Skype to place phone calls over the internet. Again, we have two entrepreneurs who had an innovative idea for an application. Network engineers didn't think it would work, but it didn't matter. The application constituted a huge threat to network providers' business models, but it didn't matter. And for Zenstrom Freeze, it didn't matter because there was nothing network providers could do about this. And there was nothing they could do about this because at the time, the internet's architecture prevented them from interfering with the applications and content on their networks. As I said, the internet was based on the broad version of the end-to-end arguments. As a consequence of this design, the internet couldn't distinguish between applications and content on the network. It was application blind. And as a result, the network providers couldn't control the applications and content on their network. Today, that's different. Today, sophisticated technology is available that enables network providers to identify the applications and content on their network and to control their execution. Thus, the original internet was application blind. Today's internet is not. Does it matter? Imagine you have this great idea for a video platform that will revolutionize the way people watch TV. Once they've used your application, they will never go back to cable again. Of course, there are risks. The technology may not work. Users may not like your product. Your business model may be wrong. But in the application blind network, you know that you'll get a fair chance in the marketplace. You'll be able to compete with other applications on the merits. In today's network, cable providers may squash you. The network can turn against you anytime and block your application or slow it down. There are many reasons why network providers may want to do so. Maybe your application competes with theirs, the way Vonage, the internet telephony application, competed with Madison River's traditional telephony service. Maybe they just want to share off your profit. Maybe they don't like your content, the way TELUS, the Canadian ISP, didn't like the discussions among members of a union with which TELUS was engaged in a contentious labor dispute. And so TELUS just blocked the website on which these discussions were taking place. Or your application is slowed down to manage bandwidth, the way Comcast shut down the torrent connections in order to manage bandwidth on Comcast's network. But whatever the network provider's reasons, if your application gets blocked, your project fails, and you won't be able to reap its benefits. And accounting for this possibility, you or potential investors may decide not to pursue your idea. Third story. When YouTube came on the market, it competed with Google Video. YouTube was better. It won. In today's internet, things might have been different. In today's internet, in an application-aware network, the network provider can ask applications to pay an access fee, a fee for the right to reach the network provider's internet service customers. There are a number of ways in which it could do so, and I'm happy to talk more about them in the discussion. But here I want to focus on one possibility. When YouTube came on the market, network providers might have said, Google, you are big. You have lots of money. Why don't you give us some of that money and we will give Google Video better transport? Imagine Google pays. Suddenly, Google Video is so much better. Not because it's the better product, but because Google is rich and Google was able to strike a deal. Suddenly, network providers get to decide who is successful by deciding who gets a deal. Suddenly, network providers, not users, get to pick winners and losers on the internet. And I'll talk about why this is a problem in a second. Assume we decided to prevent this problem by forcing network providers to offer and charge for these services in a non-discriminatory way. So if a network provider offers better service to YouTube, it also needs to offer it to Google Video, and vice versa. But even then, these types of access charges will still give an advantage to established companies with deep pockets over innovators with little or no outside funding. Why? How would innovators with no or little outside funding pay the access fee? After all, they don't have a lot of money. Subscription fees? Existing applications usually don't charge subscription fees. Advertising revenue? New applications usually don't command significant advertising revenue. Venture capital might be a solution, but my research shows that innovators are often unable to get it. Thus, many innovators wouldn't be able to pay access fees, giving those who can pay an immediate competitive advantage. And foreseeing this, innovators with no or little outside funding may stop innovating on quality of service sensitive applications altogether. So three stories, three different factors. How do changes in these factors affect the amount and quality of application innovation? Some changes may affect the benefits and costs of application innovation. An innovator decides to innovate if the benefits, broadly defined, are larger than the costs. Increase the costs or reduce the expected benefits, for example, through access charges or discrimination, and some innovations may just not be justified anymore. Some changes may affect the size and diversity of the innovator pool. For example, access charges may reduce the profits of all affected application developers, but they may hit certain types of innovators, those with no or little outside funding, particularly hard. Other changes may let network providers, not users, decide which applications will be successful and how the network can be used. Why are these things important? If there is uncertainty, for example, about technology or user needs, or if user needs are very heterogeneous, a larger and more diverse group of innovators will develop more and better applications than a smaller, less diverse group of innovators. And these applications will better meet users' needs. What's the intuition here? If there is uncertainty, nobody really knows which applications will work or which applications will be successful. Under these circumstances, economic theory suggests that it's best to try out many different ideas and see what happens. Some will succeed, some will fail, but trying is the only way to find out. And because different people will have different ideas and different views of the world, more and more diverse innovators will have more and more diverse ideas. A larger and more diverse group of potential innovators will also realize more of the ideas that are known. For example, startups may have an incentive to realize applications that established firms wouldn't pursue, or users who want to use the application themselves have an incentive to create applications that manufacturers who just want to sell the applications would never produce. By contrast, fewer innovators or less diverse innovators will try fewer things, leaving valuable ideas on the table. So innovator diversity is important. But that's not the whole story. My book highlights the importance of a specific subgroup of innovators, those with no or little outside funding. As I said, in the original architecture of the internet, almost anybody can be an innovator. And this allows innovators with a wide range of motivations and funding models to develop new applications. By contrast, things like access charges would remove or at least impede the ability of a large subgroup of innovators, those with no or little outside funding, to develop new applications. The consequences of this loss would be severe. Throughout the history of the internet, many of the most important innovations have been developed by innovators of this type. eBay or Facebook, which were developed by innovators in their free time, Yahoo or Google, which were developed by grad students, the Apache web server or the World Wide Web, which were developed by users, or Flickr or Blogger, which were developed by companies or startups with little or no outside funding. Often, these innovators tried to get venture capital, but weren't successful. This happened, for example, to eBay, Google, Blogger, and Flickr very early in their history. So in a world where network providers can charge access charges, these applications wouldn't have been able to get off the ground. I sometimes hear that the internet has matured. some application and content providers are now multi-million dollar companies. So maybe we don't need low-cost innovation anymore. I don't think that's correct. There are many more applications out there waiting to be developed. And as much as I like Google or Amazon or Yahoo, I don't think that they'd be able or even interested in developing many of them. Think about it. Classifieds were revolutionized by eBay and Craigslist, not by the newspapers. Music distribution was revolutionized by Napster, Kazaa, BitTorrent, and iTunes, not by the music industry. The commercial potential of the World Wide Web was identified by Netscape, not by Microsoft. And online bookstores got off the ground with Amazon, which was founded by someone who had a degree in electrical engineering and computer science and had worked as a senior manager, as the senior vice president at a quantitative hedge fund before funding Amazon. It wasn't revolutionized by Barnes and Noble. My research suggests that all this is not an accident. Established companies have very different cost structures, backgrounds, and motivations that let them focus on very different applications than the type of applications that all these different kinds of low-cost innovators would focus on. I don't want to be stuck with the applications that the established companies choose to develop. Thus, if we want to protect application innovation, we need experimentation by a large, diverse group of innovators, and this group needs to include innovators with little or no outside funding. But widespread experimentation is only part of the mechanism that produces innovation under uncertainty. The second is, who gets to decide which applications will be successful? Users or network providers? And does it matter? I argue it does, because users and network providers will choose different criteria when they choose among applications. There are two reasons. First, users and network providers use different criteria when they choose which applications will be successful. Users choose the application that best meets their needs. That's easy. Network providers use different criteria. Does this application compete with mine? Does it create a lot of bandwidth? Does my preferred vendor happen to offer network management software that blocks this application? Consider Skype. Many mobile providers in Europe don't allow their users to use Skype over the mobile internet. If you look at user forums, you see that users don't like that. They want to use Skype on their cell phones. But if users use Skype, they don't place as many traditional cell phone calls, and voice revenue shrinks. So network providers make a decision that's very different from the decision that users would make if they had the choice. And second, even in those cases where network providers would like to choose the applications that users want, they don't necessarily know what these are. That's the uncertainty I talked about earlier. In many cases, nobody knows whether an application will be successful until users actually try it. And network providers just can't replace this trial and error by users. Beyond innovation, user choice is also important if we want the internet to provide the maximum value for society. But that's a different story. Thus, if network providers pick winners and losers on the internet, if they decide which applications will be successful and how users can use the network, users may end up with applications they wouldn't have chosen and may be forced to use the internet in a way that doesn't create the value it could. In sum, there are a number of aspects that foster application innovation. Innovators independently decide which applications they want to pursue. Users independently decide which applications they want to use. The application blindness of the network ensures that the network provider cannot interfere with these choices, that it cannot distort competition among applications or classes of applications, or reduce application developers' profits through access charges. Finally, the low cost of application innovation not only make many more applications worth pursuing, but also allow a large and diverse group of people to develop new applications, which in turn increases the overall amount and quality of innovation. Allowing network providers to discriminate or charge access fees breaks this mechanism at its core. It reduces application innovation. It reduces the value users and society can realize from the internet. It also removes, though I didn't have time to talk about it, the very features that have allowed the internet to improve democratic discourse, facilitate political organization and action, or provide a decentralized environment for social and cultural interaction in which anybody can participate. Thus, discrimination, blocking, or access charges are not in the interest of society. Network providers' interests point in a different direction. Blocking, discrimination, and access charges increase their profits. At the same time, network providers capture only a small part of the social benefits associated with things like application innovation, free speech, or a more participatory culture. And even the gains they are able to capture are uncertain and will mostly be realized in the future, which causes network providers to consider them even less. However, network providers control the network infrastructure, and so it's not surprising that they change this infrastructure according to their commercial interests. Thus, there is a gap between network providers' private interests and the public's interest, or as lawyers and economists call it, a market failure. Given this gap, we face an important choice. Leaving the evolution of the network to network providers will significantly reduce the internet's value to society. If we want to preserve this value, policymakers will have to intervene and protect the features that were at the core of the internet's success. And that's exactly what the network neutrality debate is all about, protecting the features that were at the core of the internet's success. How to do so without overly constraining the evolution of the network or without creating high costs of regulation is a tricky question. And I hope we'll be able to talk more about that during the discussion. But I want to be very clear here because I'm often misunderstood on this topic. I'm not saying we need to preserve the original architecture of the internet. That would be crazy. I'm saying we need to preserve the factors that have fostered application innovation and made the internet useful to society. That is the factors that I've just talked about, and that's not the same as preserving the original architecture of the internet. And because that sounds totally abstract, I want to talk for a moment about the relationship between network neutrality and quality of service to illustrate what I mean. For those of you who are not network engineers and think about quality of service on a daily basis, let me give you some background. So in the original internet, the internet provides a single best effort service. That means the network does its best to deliver the packets, the data packets, but it does not provide any guarantees with respect to delay, bandwidth, or losses. In this way, it's very similar to the normal postal service where, you know, if you mail a letter, the postal service doesn't tell you when it will arrive or whether it will arrive at all. But different applications have different needs. For example, internet telephony is very sensitive to delay, but doesn't really care about the occasional packet loss. By contrast, email is very sensitive to packet loss, but doesn't care about some delay. So we could imagine a network that treats applications differently according to their needs. So we could give low delay service to internet telephony and best effort service to email. And a network that offers different service to different data packets, that's a network that we say offers quality of service. In the network neutrality debate, the question of quality of service is relevant when we talk about how to define discrimination. And again, you know, for those of you who don't necessarily follow the network neutrality debate this closely, I want to talk for a moment about what this means. So imagine you're a regulator and you're thinking about whether your country needs network neutrality rules. then you have to think through a series of questions in order to decide which rules to adopt, if any. The first question is, do we need a rule against blocking applications? If there is no rule against blocking, it's not a network neutrality proposal. So, you know, all network neutrality proponents, no matter how much they disagree about all the other questions, think blocking is a danger and we need a rule against blocking. And the story that's usually told to exemplify why we need that is the story of Skype. But what about behavior that stops short of blocking? For example, if Comcast slows down internet video applications like YouTube or Hulu, which compete with Comcast's own internet video application, Fancast, should this be prohibited? Within the network neutrality debate, the term for this type of behavior that stops short of blocking is discrimination. And the question for regulators is, should we ban only blocking or blocking and discrimination? And if we ban discrimination, how should discrimination be defined? So the first option that is the one that network providers would prefer is the following. So network providers would probably say having quality of service in the network would be really beneficial. Think of all the amazing applications we could get if only we had quality of service. And then they turn around and say, but you know, it's really tricky to distinguish between beneficial and harmful discrimination, so we should just give up on that and allow all forms of discrimination. And that effectively means we have no rule against discrimination. And I think that's a bad choice, because having a rule that bans blocking but allows discrimination makes the rule against blocking meaningless, because discrimination is an effective alternative to blocking, but it's actually less costly. So think about it. If you want to use an application and it just doesn't really work, it's so slow and you get really annoyed, a lot of people won't know what's happening here and they just give up and stop using the application. And many people won't really understand that it might be the network provider that has something to do with the bad performance of the application. You know, they may blame it on bad design, bad service, congestion in the network. And so from the point of the view of the network provider, that means that people will be less suspicious of the network provider and less people may switch in response to blocking. So this is not a good rule. The other alternative might be to say, okay, then let's just block all discrimination. Let's force network providers to treat every packet the same. And if you listen to my description of quality of service, you'll immediately see that this means no quality of service in the network, because quality of service by definition entails treating different packets differently. So these people, Susan Crawford is one example of a person who supports this option, are really concerned about network providers distorting competition. And, you know, I think that's a laudable goal. I share that. But this option is actually too restrictive because, as we see, there are ways in which we can protect competition and innovation without totally banning quality of service. But if that's the case, then we shouldn't constrain the evolution of the network more than absolutely necessary to protect the values that we care about, and so this is not a good solution. If you then talk to these people, they might say, yeah, but you know, if you talk with network engineers, they will tell you that the value of quality of service as a technical solution is not that clear. Many network engineers think quality of service is just too complex, and so we just add capacity to the network. So banning quality of service is totally fine because adding more capacity is the better solution from a technical perspective. And whatever I may think about this debate from the perspective of a network engineer, I don't think this is the type of argument that regulators should use. The regulators need to care about the social values, about protecting application innovation and user choice and free speech. But they are not the right people to make technical decisions, to decide debates among network engineers. And so whatever we think about the value of quality of service, you know, if we can protect the values that we care about without totally banning quality of service, I think that's the right way to go. So all or nothing approaches don't work. My preferred approaches are approaches that try to preserve the application blindness of the network. And you know, if you listen to the story of Skype and YouTube, we heard that application blindness was very important in making sure that we have a level playing field and everything. And so the idea is to preserve this factor, but in a way that constrains the evolution of the network as little as possible. What would this look like? The general idea is to say we ban all application-specific discrimination. That is, discrimination that's somehow tied to the application, because we think that would allow network providers to use, you know, put all their bad motives in play. But we allow them to do all sorts of application-agnostic discrimination because it has nothing to do with the application, and so presumably they will only engage in it if it's useful. Application-agnostic discrimination, to give you some examples, might be, for example, allocating bandwidth based on the amount of money people pay for using the network. So, you know, if you pay twice as much as I do, you might get twice as much bandwidth as I do during times of congestion. But that would be an application-agnostic criteria, as opposed to a world where, let's say, Comcast says, if you use BitTorrent during times of congestion, we won't let you do that. We only will let you do other stuff. So that would be application-specific discrimination. But still, you know, this sounds very intuitive, but there are actually two ways in which we could define application-specific discrimination. The first is we only ban discrimination based on applications. And the second is we ban discrimination based on applications or classes of applications. So that sounds very abstract again. So what does this mean? Let's start with the first option. If we ban discrimination based on application, then you cannot treat Fancast better than Hulu, but you can also not treat YouTube better than Hulu, for example. So you cannot take one application and treat it better or worse than others. And the idea is, again, that would allow network providers to distort competition among applications. But this option would allow you to do discrimination based on class of application. And that's something that we call like treatment. And the Google Verizon legislative framework proposal actually had like treatment as an option under the things they described as reasonable network management. So what's the idea of like treatment? The idea is that we allow people to treat like applications alike, or we force them to treat like applications alike. So you need to treat applications within a class the same. But if there is an application class where applications have different needs, you can make distinctions between the classes. So for example, you can treat internet telephony differently from email, but you cannot make distinctions within the class and treat Skype differently from Vonage. And the intuition is very easy. You know, it doesn't really harm email if you give low delay to internet telephony but not to email, because email doesn't really care about delay. So this sounds very, very innocent, and you would think it's a nice idea. But I actually don't think it's a good idea, so let me tell you why. The first problem is that if we require like treatment, the classes of applications are actually not well defined, and that gives the network provider plenty of room to mess with competition among applications or classes of application. Let me give you two examples. The first is about distorting competition among classes of application. So if I'm a network provider, I might say, I would really like to give low delay treatment to online gaming, because online gamers derive lots of value from online gaming. And if I was selling the service to them, I could capture some of that value for myself. So low delay for online gaming is a good idea. Low delay for internet telephony is not such a good idea, because that would enable all these internet telephony applications like Skype and Vonage to better compete with my own telephony service, whether it's digital voice or the traditional telephony service. So the network provider might say, okay, so I give low delay treatment to online gaming, but not to internet telephony. So these are my two classes. So all the network engineers in the room should now be up in arms and say, but that's crazy, that's the wrong class. The right class should be delay-sensitive applications. Online gaming and internet telephony are both sensitive to delay, so they should be in the same class. And so you can't just treat online gaming differently from internet telephony. And I totally agree. The problem is, if you are not the network provider and not the FCC, it can be very costly and painful to get the FCC to decide that, no, this was actually the wrong choice and you need to treat online gaming and internet telephony the same. So because network providers are the ones who do, and then everything else happens later, you give some room for distorting competition. The second example is, we might even use this definition of classes to distort competition among applications within a class. And the Canadian network management proceeding provided an interesting example of that phenomenon. So the Canadian regulator had a proceeding where they looked at the network management practices of all the Canadian ISPs. And as part of that proceeding, they found that many, if not most, of the Canadian ISPs slowed down peer-to-peer applications either during times of congestion or just all day. And when asked about it, they would say, oh, we only do this because we want to protect all the real-time video that's being streamed across the internet and that really suffers from the delay that's introduced by congestion. So the argument is, we slow down peer-to-peer file-sharing software because we want to protect applications that stream video in real time. Then this application called Voos comes along and says, well, what about me? I'm an application that streams video in real time. But I use the peer-to-peer file-sharing protocol BitTorrent to do that. So are you blocking me during times of congestion? Or are you actually giving me better treatment to treat me like YouTube or other streaming video applications? The proceeding never found out what actually happened in these cases. And even though a couple of companies and innovator groups and public interest groups brought a complaint afterwards saying, you know, this is a really important question and you need to look into this, the regulator said, oh, no, not really. And so this question stayed unresolved. And most people think that they just slow down all peer-to-peer file sharing applications. So it's not just a hypothetical example. It shows you how you can define classes in a way that allows you to treat one application that streams video differently from another application that streams video. Okay, so distorting competition is the first problem. The second is that you can easily see that this type of regime will create lots of disputes over what's in the same class, what should the class be like. And these are questions that are not easy to resolve and require lots of expertise and network engineers. And so the cost of regulation of this regime would be high. Third problem, in this regime, it's the network providers, not the users, who choose who gets which quality of service. And you can immediately see that conflicts with the principle of user choice, where I said, oh, yeah, you know, that's a really important principle that has served the internet well in the past. So what's the problem here? If you look at all of us, our preferences for quality of service are not necessarily the same, and even for the same person, they are not necessarily fixed over time. So if I'm at home tonight, I'm waiting for a video to download, and while I'm doing that, I'm just chatting on the phone, on Skype, with my friend. I don't really care as much about the quality of the phone conversation because what I really care about is my video. The next morning, when I'm on the phone in a phone conference or, you know, I have a job interview using Skype, I care a lot about the quality of the phone. You know, I want crystal clear quality. So my preferences for quality of service may vary over time, and the network providers have no way to find out, you know, what we really want. They make static allocations. You know, internet telephony gets this treatment, this type of application gets that treatment. And so this type of system doesn't meet user preferences as well, and therefore creates less value than a system in which users made this choice. Final problem, suddenly innovators need support from the network to get the type of quality of service they want. You know, if you think back to the story of eBay, not requiring support from the network provider was actually really important. Imagine you're this new innovator with a new application, and now suddenly you have to go out and convince all the application, all the network providers worldwide that your application really needs quality of service. Well, first, you don't necessarily have this big department sitting ready to go out and call all these people, because a startup is usually a few people, mostly tech people, you know, coding away to make sure that the project works, not people ready to call network providers and negotiate. But even if you have these people, you won't necessarily get the quality of service you need for two reasons. One is, network provider may just not get it. You know, they may say, you are not in this class, and that has happened a lot in the past, not with respect to quality of service, but where network providers just wouldn't see the usefulness of a certain application, for example. And then, even if they do get it, they may not want to give you what you need for, you know, bad reasons that we talked about. So requiring support from the network provider reduces the chance that your application actually gets the quality of service it needs, and that's a bad thing. And for these reasons, I think that like treatment, even though it sounds totally innocent at first, isn't a good idea. Instead, I think we should do this. We should ban applications, all discrimination based on application or class of application, but allow all application agnostic discrimination. And so it would not be okay to treat Skype differently from Vonage, that's based on application, and not okay to treat internet telephony differently from email, that's discrimination based on class of application. Okay, so now you should look at me and say, wait a minute, first you spend all this time explaining to us why quality of service is a good idea, and why it may really make sense to treat applications differently, and then you tell us you can't treat email differently from internet telephony? That doesn't make sense. Well, it does, and that's the beauty of this proposal, which is it actually allows certain, but not all, forms of quality of service. And here are the types of quality of service it would allow. And they need to meet three conditions. The first is the different types of service are offered on a non-discriminatory basis. So the network just makes these types of service available. It might offer a low delay service, a best effort service, a less than best effort service, a guaranteed bandwidth service. And then the users get to choose when to use which class of service. So if there is a low delay service, I might use it for online gaming. You know, Barbara might use it for internet telephony. And my crazy grandmother might use it for email, which doesn't make any sense. But under this proposal, she could totally do that. That's her choice. And then the third criterion is the network provider is only allowed to charge its own internet service customers for use of these different types of service. It's not allowed to charge application or content providers who are not its internet service customers. And while the first two conditions directly flow from the way we have defined application-specific discrimination, the third condition is justified by the story of YouTube that I just told you, and you know would have to be encoded separately. So if we allow these types of quality of service, suddenly all the problems with like treatment go away. The network providers are not able to distort competition anymore, because they don't have a say in who gets which quality of service. The only things they can do that are involve differential treatments are application agnostic things, and they won't be able to distort competition among applications. In this proposal, the users choose which quality of service they want. So if we have different preferences for quality of service, or if our preferences change over time, we can act on these preferences. And so our preferences are met in a much better way than under this alternative proposal, and the internet creates much more value for users this way. And finally, then the application doesn't need any support from the network provider anymore. So we are back in the situation of the original internet, where the only people who need to be convinced that this application needs quality of service are the innovator, who somehow needs to communicate this to the user, and then the user who needs to make the choice to actually use quality of service. But the network provider is totally removed from this situation. Beyond that, you know, this solution doesn't constrain the evolution of the network more than absolutely necessary to protect the values that we care about. And here I just talked about quality of service, but it also applies to forms of managing your network, you know, all forms of managing your network in an application-agnostic way, like the Connex proposal that's currently developed by the Internet Engineering Task Force, would all be allowed under this type of proposal. And finally, application-agnostic versus application-specific is a relatively intuitive criterion for people who work with networks. I mean, I found that lawyers find it sometimes quite difficult to get their head around this, but the people who would actually have to make this decision find it a very intuitive criterion. And so we would expect that the costs of regulation are much lower than in the alternative proposal. Beyond that, the proposal provides certainty for industry participants because we can tell whether a certain type of discrimination is application-specific or application-agnostic. Network providers know how they can use their network. And if you are an innovator or an investor and you think about whether to invest in your application, you can actually see and you can have certainty that you won't be discriminated against. So for these reasons, I think we should ban all application-specific discrimination, allow all application-agnostic discrimination, and define application-specific discrimination as including discrimination based on applications and classes of applications. So this was a long exploration of different non-discrimination rules, and it had 2 points. The first was to show you, you know, it's actually possible to preserve the factors that have fostered application innovation in the past. We talked about application blindness, about user choice, about low cost of application innovation. That was the YouTube part that came into the story, about not requiring support from the network. And still, we allow the network to evolve in a way that's different from the original architecture of the internet. And of course, you know, I hope that it also made you understand something about non-discrimination rules and what they might look like, what a good solution might be. Of course, these are not the only proposals, and right now I just want to hint at them. The first one is the one that Julius Janikowski just proposed. It means ban discrimination that is unreasonable. The second is the one that was in the Google Verizon legislative framework proposal. Ban discrimination that's anti-competitive and harms users. And the third one is ban discrimination that is not disclosed. That's the solution that the Europeans have chosen. And I'm happy to talk about all of these in more detail. Right now, I just want to say 2 things. One, the solution that the chairman proposed is better than the one that Google proposed. But the only reason it's better is because it's not as bad. And we can talk about why that is, you know, in the discussion. It's a really bad rule. It's not as bad as the Google rule, but it is bad. And so, you know, to the extent we need to do something until December 21st, that's one of the things we should do. But there is one final question that I want to talk about. I've talked a lot about application innovation. But why do we care so much about application innovation? Why should policymakers care about it? I have a longer answer to this question. It explains how application innovation contributes to economic growth and how it creates value in all areas of society. But I'm eager to start the discussion, so let me just say this. Did you ever try to explain to your partner's grandmother why she should use the internet? I did. And although I'm a computer scientist, I didn't say, "Grandma, you have to get the internet. It's so cool. It lets you send data packets back and forth." No. I said, "Grandma, if you get the internet, you can call us and see your grandchildren on the screen. And if you post pictures, you can see them immediately after we post them. And you can read about anything you can possibly imagine." Thus, The internet doesn't create value through its existence alone. It creates value by allowing us to do the things we want to do things we never knew we wanted to do, or do things more efficiently. Applications are the tools that let us realize this value in all areas of society. And by protecting the factors that have fostered application innovation in the past, we can make sure that the internet will be even more useful and valuable in the future. Thank you for your attention. So we hope that you'll have lots of questions. Elaine and Amanda have mics. And do we want to start over here? Amanda?
Well, you'll hold it for me. How nice. So I have two big issues I want to go over. The first is, I think there was a very important other element of non-discrimination in the early internet that was actually the most important element. It was the lack of price discrimination. Mm-hmm. It was the fact that packets weren't accounted for. The internet's cost contract was, I pay for my line to the middle, you pay for your line to the middle, and we don't account for anything else beyond that. Each person's paid their half. It wasn't free, but it had that appearance of free. So this non-discrimination based on price, which was only based on how much bandwidth you wanted to buy, how many megabits you wanted to buy, resulted, I think, in most of the innovation, because people didn't have to go to bean counters or explain why there was a lot of traffic on the camera showing the fish tank of the company, or the cool thing that they had developed. I think that was actually the most important thing. Unfortunately, I fear that a lot of the attempted regulations of network neutrality seem to push the carriers into doing price discrimination as the only thing left to them to engage in the discrimination they want to do for their own business reasons. And if we push them into price discrimination, if we push them into having more tiers into how many megabytes you use during the month, or if you download really large videos, you have to pay, but if you just do email, you don't have to pay, except for our video service, which is part of our price. If we push them into price discrimination, couldn't we do more harm? So that's number one, and I'll do number two after some other people have spoken.
Okay, so I probably wouldn't define what you talk about as price discrimination. When economists talk about price discrimination, they usually mean that you sell the same thing, but people pay different prices. You mean usage-based pricing. And because, just to make this clear, the proposal would actually rule out a lot of price discrimination that carriers might want to engage in. So I've heard proposals to charge differently, even though you provide the same service for email as opposed to music, as a way to enable network providers to capture more value from the services that people are using. And in Europe, for example, the mobile providers are moving heavily in that direction, where, for example, you can buy a normal internet contract. But interestingly, that contract excludes the right to use internet telephony. And then you can use an additional option. And the only thing that option does is give you the right to also use internet telephony, but it costs $10 extra. And what this does effectively is make internet telephony more expensive and allow the network provider to capture some of that value. That would be an application-specific type of charging, and that would be banned under my proposal. But your question was a different question, which was, aren't we just pushing network providers towards usage-based pricing? And wouldn't that be a bad thing? And I have mixed feelings about that. I agree with you that having flat rate pricing has lots of benefits. For the users, the big benefit is you don't really have to think about how much you use, and you have certainty about your expenditure. But from the point of view of society, the benefit is if I think about whether I spend a few more moments on Wikipedia or on a blog post or on trying to use a new application, I do that because the marginal cost of doing that is zero to me. And all these activities are the activities that we want to support. And so there are things that are about flat rate pricing that are really valuable for society. But I also see the problem that, network providers are moved in a certain corner if everybody just pays a flat rate price and it doesn't matter how much you use, because the effect of that seems to be people use the internet more, bandwidth increases, but the revenue of the providers doesn't increase, and that creates this odd incentive to actually make people not use the internet or to not make them use certain applications. And so my general answer is I really think that application agnosticism is one of the most important things, letting the users decide how they want to use the network, but that we need to think about a system in which if you use the internet more, you pay more, and potentially we still try to preserve the benefits of flat rate pricing. And what I think the solution would be is, you know, you mentioned tiers of volume caps. So it might be, you know, a 5 gigabyte tier, and then a 50 gigabyte tier, and a 250 gigabyte tier, and then unlimited maybe. And users can choose. So that's the first part. And then the idea would be that users, you know, get a sense of how much they need, and so they are generally within the tier that's right for them. That still, if it's done the way it's in the mobile, done in the mobile world, doesn't give you certainty, because in the mobile world, if you go over your tier, you pay a lot. And suddenly people have these bills of $10,000 because your kid was, you know, on the phone with their girlfriend and boyfriend all night and texting like crazy. And we don't want that on the internet, because we want people to use it without thinking about going over. And BT in the UK actually has a really nice solution to that problem, where they have this system of different tiers of volume caps. But if you go over, they don't charge you. If you go over for the first month, they tell you. And then if you go over for the second month in a row, they give you the option to either paying per gigabyte or whatever that you used more, or to move to the second tier. But what this does is that it gives you the ability to still maintain the predictability of your bill. And then the final thing that you need to think about, so you have, you know, people use the internet more, network providers earn more, which is good. You preserve the benefits of flat rate pricing to a certain degree. And then the only thing you need to do, and that's something that regulators would have to do, everything else that I've just talked about would have nothing to do with regulators. It would be network providers changing their pricing models. What regulators would have to do would be to monitor this way of pricing to make sure that this pricing isn't used to give an advantage to a proprietary video applications over others. So, of course, you know, that's what you alluded to. We would find it very easy to imagine that Comcast says, oh, you know, people who use a lot of bandwidth will probably use it for video. And so we just make it so expensive that it's not worth to cut the cord and cancel your video subscription. And then, you know, because you pay so much money for your bandwidth then anyways. And so there would be have to be some regulatory oversight to make sure that's not exploited. Elaine, do you have the next?
Two questions from my side. The first one goes on Google, Verizon, the deal where essentially Google, being a long strider for net neutrality, got in bed with Verizon and tried to convince us that different rules should apply for the mobile web. Do you think that's technologically justified right now, or is there the danger that they try to make inroads on net neutrality there, since, well, in the not too distant future, the mobile web might be just as good? The second question, now, assumed and knowing that politicians tend to be not entirely immune to well-crafted lobbying efforts, given that we lose net neutrality, or we already see the first inroads made against net neutrality, what would be perhaps in a utopian idea as users, how we could counter that, like user stakeholder based ISP, or what would be your ideas on that?
Okay, so the first question is effectively, should we have the same rules for wireless as for wireline networks? And that was, you know, featured prominently in the Google Verizon framework proposal. But it's also going to be a big area of discussion in the chairman's proposal, because from what we know, you know, just to give you a little bit of background, Janikowski gave a talk today which gave a few details about what the rules would be like. He didn't give a lot of details. The rule that is circulated is confidential, so people don't know about it. But what we know is that it's based on a legislative bill, a proposal for a bill that was negotiated in Congress in September by Chairman Waxman, so the so-called Waxman bill. And that was the preferred solution of AT&T that AT&T has been lobbying for at the commission. And what, from what we hear, that's what the commission has taken as the floor and then added a few improvements. And the Waxman bill had a very peculiar treatment for wireless, which was you cannot block websites, you cannot block applications that offer video telephony or voice telephony, but only if they compete with applications that the provider already offers. Beyond that, you can block as much as you want. The only thing is you need to tell people about the blocking that's going on. No rule against discrimination, and as you can see, a very limited blocking rule. The Verizon Google proposal was worse because it basically said, I think, no protection for wireless. And so this whole question, is wireless different, or should the same protections apply, has been a very important question and will be until December 21st. And my answer is, so the values and the need for protection is just the same as in the open internet. You know, all the arguments that I've made are the same whether you are a wireless user or a wireline user. We want to foster application innovation. We want to foster free speech. There is a danger of discrimination and so on. All the arguments carry over to the wireless space, and it's particularly important given that a lot of people predict that in about 10 years, wireless internet will be the only way and one of the most important way in which users access the internet. And similarly to the extent that we are interested in having wireless as a competitive option that puts pressure on wireline, we need the same protections to apply because otherwise it won't be a substitute for us. You know, if I can choose between a very limited internet service on wireless and then everything on wireline, that's not a real choice. Of course, the network providers point out that it's a different technology. Wireless is a different technology, and that's true. The interesting thing is that we can take care of the difference in technology within this proposal, and that's through one part of the proposal that I didn't talk about yet. So all these rules, you know, no matter whom you talk to, have the following structure. They say blocking is not okay and discrimination is not okay, except if it's reasonable network management. So, you know, the first big question is, how do we define blocking and discrimination? But then the second really important question is, well, how do we define reasonable network management? Because if the network providers had their way, their preferred solution is, well, if we block an application or discriminate against it because we are managing our network, that should be totally fine. So we just say network management and we are out of the rule. And network neutrality proponents say that's really bad because if I'm an application provider, I don't care, or even a user, I don't care why my application is blocked. I want to get to the users and I don't get money and revenue and nobody gives me money to invest in my application if I can't get to users. And so it doesn't care whether it's network management or anti-competitive provider or someone who just doesn't like my content. And so, you know, every network neutrality proponent will tell you we need a strong, reasonable network management exception. So how does wireless then get taken care of through this exception? My solution and the solution of many network neutrality proponents would be to say, we impose very strong requirements on network management. We say, if you want to manage your network, for example, during times of congestion, you need to do it as non-discriminatory as possible, which in my proposal would mean as application agnostic as possible. But we can imagine a situation where that's not possible. So the very easy case is an application attacks your network. So yes, of course, you can't protect against that in an application agnostic way. You need to target that specific application, that's fine. So that would be one example in which it's okay because you can't do it as application agnostic as possible. And wireless would be another area where if a network provider said, look, for these reasons, I really can't be application agnostic here. Then they would have a safety valve, and to do it in a way that's application specific, but they would have to try to do it application agnostic first. And we would expect that, you know, the area of what you can do in application specific in application agnostic ways is larger on wireline than on wireless. Having said that, it's very easy to forget that not all wireless technologies are the same. And so if I talk with people who develop LTE, the next generation wireless technology, they all say, there is no problem doing things in an application agnostic way. You know, LTE is going to be a real competitor with DSL, bandwidth-wise, and everything. You know, there is much more bandwidth. And of course, you still need to manage your network, but it's totally doable to do it in application agnostic ways. And then we still have the reasonable network management exception. But the network providers are those who say wireless is really different. Just try to focus people's attention on the old wireless technologies. And so, you know, that's a really long way of saying it's as important to protect wireless as it is to protect wireline. And yes, there are technical differences, but to the extent they exist, we can take care of them through the reasonable network management solution. Dave Crocker is behind you, Amanda.
Speaking to your concern about blocking, a couple of IETF meetings ago, the secondary hotel was blocking everything but the web. You couldn't send or receive email. I have no idea what their logic was, but I thought it was a good demonstration of why blocking is bad. Your agnostic approach, which really is just defining categories of service and then letting people lay their applications on top of them as they see fit, it's clearly designed to try to neutralize gaming opportunities, but what it doesn't seem to speak to is just how good some of these people are at gaming and the likelihood that they will define categories that match their applications and do not match other people's applications.
Give me an example.
Well, I'm not very good at gaming. The kinds of VOIP that get done vary by different services, and what they demand from the infrastructure might vary quite a lot.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll
and
use
so
that.
You might imagine, just to spin this example for a moment, that you know you optimize the performance of your low delay service and the jitter characteristics, jitters, the variability in delay, to be perfect for your own application. But maybe, you know, Skype wouldn't have needed as much, or something else might need even more. And so, yes, I agree. That is, you know, not unthinkable. I still think it's better than, you know, just ruling out quality of service altogether. And at least what this gives you is that as soon as they offer a specific category, no matter what they thought this might be useful, everybody can use it for whatever they think it's good for. And, you know, this sort of unpredictability, you offer something and people do crazy things that you'd never have imagined, that's still possible. And so, yes, I agree, there might be some gaming, but I'm willing to take the risk in order to allow quality of service to happen if people really think it's necessary. And I want to give you one additional part of the big picture to give you some of the rationale for why I really think we want to allow some forms of quality of service in the open internet. So to understand this, you have to think back to the network neutrality proposal that Chairman Janikowski suggested in September 2009. In that proposal, he said, we have a very strict non-discrimination rule which says you have to treat every packet the same. And then the network providers had all these great arguments about quality of service, and you know, one of their preferred arguments is, but what if we have a health monitoring service and your grandmother dies because the kid next door is doing illegal file sharing all the time, and so the little signal that would have said, beep, beep, I'm dying, you know, that never reaches the health provider. And so Janikowski listened to that and said, yeah, I think you have a point here. And so his solution to that was to say, okay, we'll keep the internet, the open internet, nice and pure, But we will invent this new category, this what they called managed services, where you can do all the things that you wouldn't be able to do in the open internet. So you can offer quality of service. The network provider can decide who gets it. You know, in the original notice of proposed rulemaking, it was very clear that charging application and content providers is not okay. But of course, it would be okay to do this under managed services. And so if you think about this picture, you can't do quality of service in the open internet, but the network providers can do whatever they want to do in managed services, then suddenly you move into a world where every application that actually needs quality of service is pushed towards this category of managed services. And because the FCC doesn't really think it will impose a lot of regulations on it, it won't be very pretty. So economic theory, for example, would suggest that it might be more profitable to auction off the right to offer the exclusive health monitoring application to a single provider, because that provider might be willing to be more if it's the only one than if you just sell it to everybody. From the point of view of consumers, that's really bad, because you don't get the choice of all the health monitoring providers that are out there. And even from the point of view of the application provider, it's bad. You know, all the application providers which don't get to be the exclusive provider, these application providers have a problem. But there is an additional problem, which involves that the only way to get to users is through that network provider, and we call this terminating access monopoly. And that enables network providers to charge monopoly prices. Whereas if it was the user who paid for this quality of service, the price would be determined by the competition among network providers. Whereas this terminating access monopoly doesn't go away even if there is competition among network providers. Because once I've made a choice for a provider, the only way to get to me is through my provider. And so the real choice, I think, is not, oh, do we want to have the internet nice and pure and no gaming whatsoever and treat every packet the same? Because then all the applications that might actually need quality of service would be in this crazy world, and I think users and application developers would be much worse off than if this was just done in the open internet. And if I want to offer a heart monitoring server, I tell people, you should get an ISP who gives you a guaranteed bandwidth service if that's what you need. And then, you know, nobody would be able to drown out your heart signal through illegal file sharing, because your bandwidth would actually be guaranteed. Jonathan.
So I apologize in advance to all the non-law nerds for this question. Chairman Jenikowski's proposal would use the FCC's Title I authority. Is that the right way to go, and what are the ramifications?
Okay, so for all the non-lawyers here, you probably heard about the Comcast order, where Comcast told BitTorrent that they shouldn't be interfering. The FCC told Comcast that it's not okay to single out BitTorrent to manage bandwidth on a network. That was in October 2008. Comcast challenged this order in part by saying, you know, you don't have any jurisdiction to do this. And in April this year, the DC Circuit Court of Appeals said, yes, Comcast, you are right. The FCC doesn't have authority to actually enforce the rules of the road for internet service, at least not in the way that you have done it here. And the regulatory backstory to this is that the Telecommunications Act works in a very interesting way. It has these buckets of services, and each bucket has a name. So Title I is information service. Title II is telecommunication service. And each name has a definition. And so if a new service comes along, you try to find out which definition it applies to. And that helps you to put it in the right bucket. And then if you're in the bucket for telecommunication service, all the rules of Title II apply to you. And then Title I, information service, is like the catch-all category for things that the legislator didn't think of when they came up with the act. And so for a really long time, since 1996, internet services over DSL were regulated under Title II as telecommunication service, which means there are non-discrimination requirements, There are rules about pricing, you know, this non-discriminatory pricing. There are rules about unbundling your networks and letting competitors on the network. And then under the Bush administration, the FCC felt, wow, this is an awful lot of regulation. And wouldn't it be much nicer if we had less regulation? And so they looked at this Title I category, the catch-all category, and what's attractive about that one is that by default, there is no regulation attached to things that land in the Title I bucket. But then the regulator can come up with additional regulation based on what we call ancillary authority. So the FCC said, this is great. We just move internet services to Title I. That will allow us to do whatever we want to do based on ancillary authority, but the default is no regulation, and network providers really like that. That's what they did. The decision went up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said explicitly as part of that argument, yeah, you know, we have only a very deferential standard when we look at this decision. We don't tell you it's the right way to interpret the law, but we tell you whether it exceeds the boundary of what the law says is possible. And it's within these boundaries. And, you know, we also think it's not a totally crazy solution, because if you want to add additional regulations later, for example, impose open access regulation that would be, you know, let other ISPs on your network, you can always do that under your ancillary authority. So everybody thought, great. And the FCC thought, great, too. And so when they enforced the Comcast order, they thought, oh, these sort of behavioral regulations, non-discrimination rules, are much less intrusive than actually letting competitors on your network. And so we'd be totally within the range of acceptable behavior in Title I. But the court said, no, you are not. And so since April, the FCC has been thinking about how to get authority to actually do what they want to do. Because Jonathan is totally right. You know, we talk about what the rules should be like, but what are the rules worth if they are based on sand? You know, if you go to court and say, you don't have authority to do that, and the court said, yeah, you're right. So, you know, game over. And for most of the year, the FCC has said, you know, we think the right solution is to go back to Title II, which, as a lawyer, I can tell you that would be totally reasonable, because legally the reclassification decision was wrong in the first place, and so you could move it back as a legal argument. And network providers hate that because they say, oh, it's monopoly regulation, all this pricing regulation, open access regulation, that would be really bad. The FCC said to that, well, we can just decide not to apply all these regulations that don't make sense, which is called forbearance. And the FCC thought that would be a nice compromise proposal. But under a lot of pressure, the chairman has decided not to go forward with this option, which most people think was the reliable option that would have been upheld in court. Of course, you never know. But the idea would have been you go to court once over this, and then you have authority for everything you need to do. So we also talk about universal service stuff. We talk about, you know, rules for disabled people to make the internet better for them. And so part of the problem with this jurisdiction question is that if you now go to Title I, every time you do something, you do universal service, you need to go back to court and show that you had jurisdiction. You want to help the disabled, you go back to court and you have to show that you have jurisdiction. You do network neutrality, you go to court and you have jurisdiction. So it's like rolling the dice every time you want to do something. So as you can probably see from my long explanation, I think it's not the right choice. The DC Circuit Court of Appeal left open a few avenues where they said, well, if you use this explanation, that might have been convincing to us if only you had made the argument. And so we expect that the FCC is now going down all these paths where the court said, well, we might have considered that argument. But the court didn't actually say, if you make that argument, we'll find it convincing. And so a lot of people expect that this is all a big fraud in a way, because we fight about the rules. We might even get rules that we like. And then 2 years later, this gets vacated in court due to a lack of jurisdiction. And so I think it's a real problem. It's a very big problem. At the same time, you know, pragmatically, we can't force the chairman to reclassify. I know that the general counsel thinks reclassifying is the best option, but you know, the chairman makes the decision. And so we live with that and we fight for the best rule that we can get, and then we'll have to see what happens. I see someone, you know, very in the back.
I wonder if the whole debate, we didn't just get a little bamboozled, not by you, but by the broadband companies. By definition, network congestion is a failure of the network. The need to throttle is because the networks are not very strong. We have given our infrastructure over to private companies who have, you know, their main interest is profits rather than investing in infrastructure, and we don't have fiber. If we all had fiber to the house, we wouldn't be having this discussion about a fixed broadband. It would only be about wireless. Any thoughts that maybe we've sort of fallen into a trap that lets Comcast, you know, continue to not put money into infrastructure?
It's a tricky question. I mean, the first thing I just want to say, I hear this argument a lot. If only we had a lot of bandwidth, we wouldn't have problems with congestion. We know from Korea that, you know, you give people lots of bandwidth, they fill it. And you still have a problem with, you know, how do you manage bandwidth on the network and how do you allocate bandwidth amongst users? And so even with more capacity, the problem doesn't really go away. That's not to say that it would be great if we had more capacity. And a big part of the debate, in a way, is trying to figure out how you can motivate the network providers to add more capacity. And, you know, part of when I talked about the people who said just treat every packet the same and don't go to quality of service, part of the concern of these people is that they say, if you let network providers offer quality of service and allow them to charge for it, you actually provide an incentive for them not to invest in their network. And the idea here is something that's very familiar to all of us who ever have, you know, set foot on a plane. So plane companies, airline companies, have an incentive to make economy class sufficiently unattractive to motivate people to pay for business class. And so, and that's not just, you know, an anecdote, it's based on a lot of economic theory of price discrimination. And so we would expect if you can offer quality of service, then the only time in which it makes sense to offer that is if it's really better than the best effort service and you actually need it in order to do internet telephony and everything. And so people say, well, we don't really want to move down that path where the network provider have an incentive to downgrade the quality of the best effort service so that we all buy quality of service. And that's, you know, related to your question, because it means we might be creating exactly the opposite incentives to what we want. And I totally share the concern. I think it's a viable concern. But for all the reasons that I gave you for why I think allowing quality of service in the open internet is ultimately a good thing, I think we should try to deal with it in a different way, in the way with which the Europeans dealt with it. And so that's interesting because the Europeans generally think competition will solve everything. And that was the one problem they thought competition didn't solve. And so they came up with a rule that says, because we are concerned about network providers degrading the quality of the baseline service, we require all the regulators to monitor the quality of the baseline service, and we give them authority to intervene if it gets below unacceptable levels. And, you know, all the lawyers in the room can now scream, because below unacceptable levels, that's a very loose term. And it might work better with a regulator like Ofcom, where Ofcom says, I'm going to regulate you. And then the industry goes like, oh, no, we behave, we be really, really nice. And so it seems that the American regulators don't have this relationship with the American providers. But I still think that trying to go down this way, at least is first to say, we're trying to scare you into behaving in a nice way because you really don't want to be regulated by us, is a better solution. I totally realize that I have sort of dodged your question about how can we get better broadband networks. And I think it's a really important question. I just don't have a good answer. I would love to have fiber that the government just puts into the ground and then everybody can offer their services over it. I just feel that, so that will be one option. Another option is that, you know, the Europeans and the Japanese and the Koreans, who all have open access, which means someone puts the network into the ground and then other independent ISPs can offer their services over that network, they all have higher bandwidth at lower prices than we have. And that's totally ironic, because the economic argument that the American providers made during this debate about whether we should keep open access, which we had, was to say, well, guys, you know, if you let other ISPs on our network, we make less profit. And if we make less profit, we'll invest less in our network. So you need to keep these independent ISPs off our network in order for us to have an incentive to deploy more and better networks. And the regulators totally bought into this. And here we are, you know, we only have two choices, high prices, no competition, and we are worse off in terms of deployment and prices than the other countries. And so personally, I think that would be a really viable option to try to get more and better broadband. It's just that the FCC has decided that they don't want to look at that. And so, you know, as much as I like that solution, it doesn't seem to be available to us right now. I'm really wary of the time. Okay, one more question. You pick one. I don't want to discriminate.
Thanks for a fascinating talk. I'm curious about as a kind of insurance to all this generative decision-making that is unfolding as we talk. You encapsulate many key points, but of course there are a lot of corporate interests, for example, that will come to bear in this developing decision-making process. I'm curious whether there's a kind of collective cooperative approach of possibly on a worldwide basis developing something like a broadband provider, as well as much in the way that the schools in this country are free, K through 12 is free, basically due to taxpayer support, and many European universities are free. Start an organization that would perhaps counter or work with, and maybe this has already happened. HCOOP in the Boston area is a series of cooperative servers. World University and School, this project I'm developing, which is like Wikipedia with MIT OpenCourseWare, has a broadband kind of mission, all languages, 3 to 8,000 languages we all teach to each other, but with MIT OpenCourseWare as kind of academic standard. What about an insurance sort of policy to generative decision-making influx?
I think it's totally fine. The more free and open networks we create, the better. I mean, in Europe, I know that, I think they call themselves free networks. They are not necessarily free, but it's people, you know, building a network based on mesh network technology. So everybody brings their bandwidth, and then the data hops from place to place, and that's actually quite successful. And so, you know, I like municipal networks, and so in the areas of the U.S. where we can do that and can have, you know, open networks, that's a good approach. I just don't think that's the only thing we should be doing. But I'm totally in favor of doing as much beyond that. And before we all move over to the reception in the faculty lounge, which is just move out this room and then to the right, I want to say one more thing, which is related to the question that, you know, one of you asked, which was, in a way, what can we do? And the question seemed to be a little bit more about, you know, can we develop technology or can we do whatever? But I think, you know, if you care about network neutrality, there are a couple of things you really can do in the next 3 weeks. The first is subscribe to the mailing list and safetheinternet.com, because that's where Free Press and the safetheinternet.com coalition have, you know, email blasts where they tell you, you know, if you want to write to the FCC, here's something you could write, and then you can customize it and write it. And that helps you stay informed. I can only tell you that it really matters to the FCC to get public pushback. You know, they have all these insanely rich network providers in the room, which have, you know, lots of lobbying powers. And to hear back from consumers in large numbers is something that matters to them. If you are an innovator of any kind, the FCC really cares about your personal story. And so if you are an innovator and you care about network neutrality, then I can only suggest that you come to me and we can talk and see whether there is anything you could do to help move the debate along. Because, you know, we didn't get to talk about this non-discrimination rule, but one of the big problems is it's undefined. And so if I'm an innovator, I don't have certainty that I won't be discriminated against, and I don't have the resources to fight the fight at the FCC to show that when I was being discriminated, it was unreasonable. And so there are many things where innovators can come and say to the FCC, look, this just doesn't make sense. Yeah, and then beyond that, there are all sorts of self-help and being nice on the internet that you can engage in. So if a network provider blocks or discriminates and you find out about it, you can call them. They hate that. They don't want to have all these support calls. So it really makes a difference if customers call and say, we hear you are blocking X on your wireless network. Don't do that. We don't like it. You can install monitoring programs on your computer that try to detect blocking. And if you're interested in that, the Network Measurement Lab, the Measurement Lab has programs that people can install. And so that's just a couple of things that you could do in order to help protect the open internet. So thanks again for coming. You know, I'll be at the reception and we can talk more.